And it gives you the final word. It's not the progressive revelation being revealed from book to book. It's the final word and overview, all of them systematically put. And it's come under a lot of criticism too. And the criticism said, what you're doing is superimposing the human intellect onto the scripture and making it fit your system. Well, that's not true, but it was one of the criticisms. So you're going to hear people dismiss biblical theology becomes what happened under the liberals. It became relativism. They would say, well, to those people, this meant that. That was Karl Barth. It became that. It wasn't absolutely true. It's a relative theology that varies from the culture and the people, and it changes. Well, there were people that abused biblical theology, so many people said, I'll have nothing to do with biblical theology. There are people that abuse systematic theology, where it just purely became almost purely topical, went through, poor exegesis, but it supported my system. I could quickly go through, give you a thumbnail approach on any subject, and I'm an expert. I don't know how many of you have backgrounds where you came from dispensational theology. Okay? A lot of people. Now, I'm trying not to create a straw man here, but I'm going to tell you something. Dispensational theology can really rest a lot more easily on a purely systematic theology. Because you can build an argument to fit your case by going through the whole scriptures, going from Daniel, going from Isaiah, going from Micah, going from Malachi, going up through Genesis, going all the way through, jumping into Revelation, jumping into Thessalonians, going all the way through, and going boom, 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 boom. See, I built my case, that's it. Now, that's an oversimplification. But the reason I'm saying this, on the book of Job, we're going to try to do something. We're not just jumping ahead and getting all the answers in the other places in the Bible. That's the easy thing to do. Now, I do make an exception here because I quote from 2 Corinthians chapter 12 here later. But my point is, when you really discipline yourself to take the passage apart, look for the theme and just think about, boy, it's interesting to see how this develops progressively throughout the whole Bible. And the Old Testament biblical theology comes to the New Testament biblical theology with the idea, I have more to receive, and I'm more and more is built upon it. So every passage, if you take that principle and learn it in the Old Testament, you can apply it to the New. When you look at the book of James, the first epistle written in the New Testament, and see how it progressively was built when Paul came along in Romans and Galatians, when the other books came along, there's a progressive revelation. There's that biblical theology. There's that theme. So when we look at this book, try to say, what did Job understand? What did the patriarchal people at that time understand? What were they applying to their lives? Not just jump ahead and say, well, you know, I know what happened. I can go over to this book and that book, and I don't have to study this. No. You get a richness. You get this mosaic that will be missed if you don't take a biblical theology view, have an overview of systematic theology. But what you need to do is say, first and foremost, let's look at the passage. Let's look and see what it says. Let's look and see how it fits. Let's see how it develops. Because even though Job says in chapter 19, I know that my Redeemer lives and I'll see him in my flesh, he does not have the same amount of revelation that Paul says when he speaks about it. 1 Peter 1:11 said people, Old Testament prophets, wrote about things they wish they knew. But that's biblical theology. It was developing. It's progressive. And yet it's amazing when we use biblical theology how much he could come to understand with the amount of revelation he had. And it's really something to shame us at times because we have a complete revelation. So kind of when we're looking at it, and by the way, if you look at that little link I put you there, if you look it up, you'll find that's a quick paper. You can read it in 10 minutes, but it's a very good overview, much better than mine. Okay. Now, let's start in chapter 2. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? Now, this looks exactly, in many ways, like chapter 1, verse 6. there was a meeting, the sons of God, which in this case has to mean angels. And there's a couple of things we have to think about. What was the time period that lapsed between chapter 1-6 and in this chapter? What was the time period? Well, there were Jewish scholars that would argue about this. They said the first one actually happened on a holy day. Well, and they said, now this one's happening on that holy day 1 year later. That presents a lot of problems. You have the three witnesses. When do they show up? It looks like there's an immediacy there. They show up after he's afflicted with the boils or the disease. After all this has happened, they come together. And it's really not a very feasible way to look at it. In all likelihood, no matter who you read, it looks like it's just a matter of a few days between the two meetings. You notice, too, that there's different language for Satan's presence. He seems to be giving a report. In Job 2:1, it says, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came also among them to present himself before the Lord. It looks like Satan's going to give a report and was summoned. How'd that work out for you, Satan? Satan's coming in. And of course, Satan's not broken. Oh, it worked out. I'm sorry. It didn't work. I misunderstood Job. No, that's not Satan. This is the hungry lion seeking whom he may devour. See, I went systematic theology. I jumped out of the book, okay? No, but he started speaking about, he started, of course, attacking again. And listen to the differences. First off, Job's faithfulness is noted in verse in chapter 2, verse 3. Let's read down a minute. Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and walking back and forth on it, just like he did in chapter 1. No acknowledgement of his failure to make Job fall. He said, then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? He said, have you considered? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. How'd that work out for you, Job? Satan, how'd that work out for you? He didn't curse me. How'd that work out? He didn't sin. What's going on there? These are all rhetorical questions. Of course, God knows what happens. He's bringing Satan in, but he's not through with Satan. So Satan comes in, and then the Satan, being Satan, Satan then comes back, and the Lord had already said, he goes, when he talks to Job, he said that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears evil, fears God and shuns evil, and still holds fast to his integrity. Even though you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. Boy, what a way to glorify God. To go through everything Job has gone through. Remember the four waves? Guy runs in from the field. You just got raided. Your oxen that were plowing next to your donkeys were all stolen and all the servants killed. The sheep were struck by lightning. Fire from heaven came down and killed them all and killed all the servants. The camels were all taken away by the invading horde and all the hordes, and all the servants were killed. And by the way, the house that your son was having his big party on and had all his brothers there and his sisters on, the four pillars collapsed and they all died. And he did not charge God foolishly. He said, I was born naked with nothing and I'll leave with nothing. And he acted righteously. And now Satan has been proven a fraud. So then he says, and although you incited him against me. Now, we have all kinds of things with the human language. We have to make allowances to communicate a message, to get the idea what Satan was up to. Satan could not incite God to do something he did not intend to do. You know, we talked about it last week. I hear some of the worst preaching in the world by modern-day evangelicals who talk about Satan and his power. They make him omnipresent. They make him where he has power unchecked because he's the prince of the earth, and there's things Jesus can't do because Satan's really in charge. They forget the passages that talk about the binding of Satan, the binding of the strong man, the going in. They forget so many passages about God, and it's just absurd teaching, absurd preaching. That's never been taught in the scripture. And biblical theology teaches us to put this together now. God is in control. Before this has become systematic, before this is something we all know, from the very earliest first book in the Old Testament, we know something. Satan does what God lets him do. The very first written book, Satan will only do what God lets him do. And God is in control and has an ultimate plan. We have this setting here. And again, remember, we're going to talk about this. Job is so key now because these early patriarchal age men, even though they're Gentiles, they're not under the Abrahamic covenant. These early patriarchal men are living at a time where there was some revelation, there were some prophets, they knew some things, but they had started to observe the obvious and build their theology about it called retribution theology. Where you live a good life, Bob, you're going to have good things. Boy, anybody ever heard that?
Claim it.
What?
Claim it in the pit, right?
Yeah. I mean, you see it all the time. You see it on television. You see it on, people go, you know, you want to get a blessing. If you buy this brick in my building, it only costs $1,100. If you buy this brick, you send me your check, God's going to bless you. And if he doesn't bless you, it's because you didn't step out by faith. When you have sin in your life, you know why? You know, it's because you sinned and didn't claim that victory. You didn't rebuke Satan. You did. From the very earliest book and the first book recorded in the Bible, we can know this. That's not how God works. And that's going to be built throughout the scripture. It's biblical theology. It's biblical. It's the principles of scripture. So Satan now is meeting God, having this meeting, and God's telling him, didn't work out. And he goes on further. He says, Satan then says, so Satan answered the Lord, skin for skin. Huh? That's an expression you and I use all the time, skin for skin. No. But we can find out what it means. He goes, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. Now, that particular passage, skin for skin, it's a proverb. But again, I warn you, I'm quoting Jameson Foster Brown, okay? And they're pretty good, but you got to watch there. They say some things that they go off the reservation, okay? So he says, supply. He will give the skin as a figurative for any outward good. Nothing outward is so dear that a man will not exchange it for some outward good, but not yea life. The inward good cannot be replaced. A man will sacrifice anything else for its sake. Satan sneers bitterly at man's egotism and says that Job bears the loss of property and children because these were mere outward and exchangeable goods. Well, he would give up all things, even his religion, in order to save his life. If you touched his bones and flesh, skin and life are antithesis. The martyrs prove Satan's sneer false. Rosenmuller explains it not so well, even though I think he actually did it better than the other guy. He said, a man willingly gives up another's skin, life, for his own skin. So Job may bear the loss of his children, etc., with equanimity, so long as he remains unhurt himself when touched in his own person. He would renounce God. Thus, the first skin means the other skin, that is the body. The second skin, one's own. Now, Matthew Henry basically says the same thing. It's, well, that's not my skin. I can deal with that. And it really is a very cynical view of a father and his children. Okay? You know, he's saying, oh, I'll gladly give up my kids. Don't do anything to me. But he's saying, but if you let me go after him, I'll show him for what he is. That's all I ask. That's all I ask. I'll show him for what he is. And I'm going to bring an affliction on him. Now, he says in verse 2:6, permission is granted. Job 2:6. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is your hand. He is in your hand, but spare his life. And it's interesting. God still sets the terms. That's never given up. If you're preaching, well, you brought yourself to God, can't do anything about it. You set yourself, you know, this just happened. At this point, live with it. We have so much bad teaching now. And can you imagine if just everybody said, look, you got no book to study today but Job. And you better learn to live on the book of Job. You better see what's going on between God, the involvement of Satan, and his saints. So he comes in, and the Bible, we think of the Apostle Paul. I just want to refer to this. It is different when you have great excruciating pain. Now, there are very few people here that can't talk about that painful experience. Maybe a tooth pulled that was abscessed, they couldn't deaden, so they had to pull the tooth without anesthesia. Maybe it was broken bones. Maybe it was a disease. Maybe it was an ongoing illness. Maybe it was chemotherapy, cancer, constant vomiting. Maybe it was whatever it is. There are a lot of physical things you can think about. There are a lot of injuries that are nagging injuries. And there are a lot of things that pain can do. You know, many times you're being discharged from maybe an accident or a surgery in the hospital. The doctors will walk up and say, here you go, you need this prescription. Why do I need that prescription? It handles the pain. I don't want that. They go, you won't heal if you're under tremendous pain. You won't heal properly. I'll take that. Or you know someone that you think you know pain. Like someone says, well, I got a bad back. You go, yeah, everybody's got a bad back. Wait till you get a bad back. I remember I've never had a problem with my back. I was in my mid-30s and in relatively good shape. And I remember, I don't know what I did. I took a long trip and it hit the sciatic nerve. It went down. And my wife will tell you, I stayed face down on the floor of the place we rented for 4 days and couldn't move. I would crawl to the bathroom. I had aspirins. I ate by the handful. I just ate them. I'd crawl in, crawl out. I remember when it got over, by the way, it never happened to me again. But when I got past it, I remember one day as I'm on my way to work, and as I'm stepping off the curb, I sneezed. Boom! I couldn't move. I would have thought someone made up that kind of pain. Pain changes things. Pain makes you react differently. Pain is all the endorphins that are released, everything that happens, all the physiological ancillary accompaniments. Pain changes everything. And pain does make you behave differently. So Satan is actually on the right track. Well, let me see what I can do about that. Now, the Apostle Paul knew a little bit about that. We've all known about Paul's affliction. Paul had just told about it. He knew of a man, he's speaking of himself undoubtedly, who was able to go up and view and had a vision of the third heaven. Not a lot of talk about it, but he was given this great revelation. Paul at this time had gone through too much. He'd gone through his missionary journeys. He'd been abandoned by people. He only had a few faithful. He was persecuted. He had suffered. He had gone through so much, coming to the end of his ministry. And the Apostle Paul was given this wonderful vision. But with it, it says in verse 7, and lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan. He understands Satan's just a tool. He said, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Now, he tells you in verse 8, he prayed 3 times for it to be removed. It was not removed. He said, and he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I would rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. As sanctified as the Apostle Paul was, I agree with Bailey Cadman. He's probably the most humble man first walking on the earth at that time. There was Moses in the Old Testament. There's Paul here. And yet, he needed this affliction in the flesh to further his sanctification and make sure he stayed a vessel conscious of his own weaknesses and limitations. Job is being shown the mercies of God through his afflictions. He's going to be blessed. It doesn't mean it's not going to be a trial, because when you see the affliction, it's really a disgusting affliction. It said that, so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. That pretty much covers everything. You can't walk around because you're in pain saying, oh, ow. You can't lay down. You can't move. He's going to be out on the ash heap, because the ash heaps, many people believe, was common practice. People had seemed to learn that it could act as a coagulant. It could be something to help you when you're attending to these sores. It was a way of setting something on off and keeping the spread of disease. It was a common practice even at that time. We don't know how people came across that, but we know they were doing it. But he's covered from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head with boils. Now, I don't want to get too graphic on this, but how many people here are aware what boils are? 5 years old, Lake Charles, Louisiana, I got boils. They don't know why. My sisters didn't get it. We don't know why. I was a young boy, always active outside doing stuff, and I remember being taken to the doctor's office by my mother, by my doctor, held down on a table when they were doing surgical procedures. I remember boils. I had them off and on for a year. They didn't have much of a cure. They gave me some things, and I used to walk around with these little boxes of raisins. They said, eat them all the time. Eat these raisins. So I think of just the few, and I think that from the bottom of my feet to the top of my head, I'm afflicted. Now, if you have in your Bibles, you have like a Reformation Study Bible, you'll see the footnote says it's really not known what type of disease this was. Boils can mean other things, but by the description, we can pretty much get a hint what's going on. Now, John Gill, this Reformed Baptist, so he gets down right to it. He says it the way it is. John Gill, and he's a fine scholar too, writes this, and it seems to be the best synopsis of what's going on. He said, and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot into his crown, with hot and burning ulcers such as were inflicted on the Egyptians in the plague of the boils and blains called the botch of Egypt, and that's in Exodus 9:10. It is and in the original text, it was with a bad boil or the worst. It was as if it were but one boil. They stood so thick and close together that they were as one, reaching from one head to foot and to spread over the whole body, that there was no part that he was not full of sores, as Lazarus. And to him may be applied what is said of the figurative sense of the Jews in Isaiah 1:6. And this boil or boils were the worst sort and most hot and angry, and gave the most exquisite pain. And what Job was smitten with at once, they did not rise up in pimples and pustules at the first, and gradually gathered and came to a head, but it was at once covered with burning ulcers at their height, with the running sores. This was done by Satan through divine permission, who, when he has leave, can afflict diseases in the bodies of men as he did in the days of Christ on earth. See Matthew 17:15. Some Jewish writers, as R. Simeon, by I should have brought my reading glasses, everything's fuzzy, that the devil heated the air and thereby caused inflammation in Job's blood, which broke out in boils, but then this would have afflicted others besides him. Many are the conjectures of learned men about the disease of Job's, some taking it to be the leprosy, others scurvy, others erysipelas, and Boldusius reckons up no less than 14 diseases that are attributed to him, collected from his own words in Job 7. There's speculation there were up to 14 diseases that would have fit that description, but it was horrible. I don't know if anybody ever had anything like that. Just imagine. We've seen people bedridden with horrible sores. That would not compare. It's like nothing you or I have ever seen. And he's sitting on an ash heap. People say, why is he sitting on an ash heap? Well, when it said that, and he took for himself a potsherd from which to scrape himself it while he sat in the midst of the ashes. A potsherd, actually, it's a shard of a pot, some say. But really, again, Fawcett Brown, they say that's really not a good translation, because the Hebrew word, the root of the word, means scratch. And he said it was a known implement to scratch yourself with, especially when you don't want to touch something that vile. And he's on an ash heap. Now, this was a prince amongst princes, the most highly esteemed man in the East. He was fabulously wealthy. He was blessed with material good. He is now destitute. He now is the pauper. He has no one to put ointment on him. He's not in his house. He's in an ash heap. It's not very likely in his house at all. Later on, he'll speak about a bed he could sleep on. He's out there scraping himself. I can't imagine. I just can't imagine. How can that type of affliction be in God's plan for anybody? I want you to preach that at the megachurch with 30,000. I want to tell you what God's plan is for Job's life. It's wonderful. Sores everywhere. Can't touch it. Scrapes them. Everybody makes him sit on the ash heap. His wife has nothing to do with him. His kids die. His money goes away. All of his health goes away. And yet he's perfectly within the will of God. And there'd be two people left. That's the Bible. That is the theology we need to study. That's biblical theology. It's to glorify God. And God rewards his saints, but God knows these people need to know this retribution theology they live by. This idea that if I do this, this, and this, God's obligated to bless me. If I do this, this, and this, I will be blessed. And when I'm not blessed, I'm not doing this, this, and this. I must be in horrible, great sin. And when we start to see the dialogue from the three witnesses, they start off, well, you know, Job, there could be a problem. And then finally, you are such a sinner. Nobody gets this kind of stuff unless you're really, really sinning. That's ungodly. Do you know Bunyan? Who read Pilgrim's Progress? What a great book. He preached the gospel. He wasn't an approved licensed minister to preach the gospel. He went to jail, and he couldn't take care of his blind daughter. Wycliffe burned at the stake. Martyr after martyr laid down their life, suffered horribly. They glorified God. It was part of his divine plan. The historical tradition of Isaiah is he was sawed in half in a log as he hid. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, he suffered. Prophets were put to death regularly. People that served God, faithful saints, died regularly. Nobody wants to hear that. If you want to purge the church, preach on the biblical theology of suffering and God's will. Well, this is the New Testament. I mean, God's a little different. No. God's unchanging. And of course, biblical theology tells us that. So he goes on further. And then his wife and her advice. And his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. There might be a reason Satan didn't kill her with the kids. I don't know. That's probably crass speculation on my part, but because he ended up having 10 more kids, probably this wife, I'm sure. But anyhow, long story short, his wife sees this, and she said, "You're still trying to hold on to your integrity? Curse God and die. Get this over with." Before we're too harsh on her, let's remember what's going on in her life. She's lost her way of life as she knew it. Their kids are dead. Her husband is probably unrecognizable in how he looks and what's going on to him. She can't approach him. She sees him suffering, and she's frustrated. And if you ever said something in frustration, you just did, it came out of your mouth, and you just said it. Now, fortunately, I've never done that. My wife does it all the time. No. But seriously, before we're too harsh, because that's really all we know about her at this point. She suffered horribly. And undoubtedly, she sat in the presence of a godly man who instructed his kids in a righteous fashion, who made intercession with God in a righteous fashion. She's seen him time and time again that his integrity before God was of the utmost importance. And she thinks, this can't go on. There's a limit to human suffering. But what did the Apostle Paul tell us? He says, my grace is sufficient. God helps his saints through the worst of times. Remember what the word sufficient means. It doesn't mean overly abundant and this is a breeze. It means it just gets you by. Where you're walking by faith and I'm walking by faith. Look what his wife said now. She said, curse God and die. Do we know that that would have happened? No. But she's asking him to deny his faith, to deny all that he's professed, and curse God. And in this horrible condition, in this unbelievable suffering, he says, no. He says to her, he goes, but he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, he did not call her a fool. He likened her unto the pagan women. And sometimes Christians, we say things that come out of our mouth, just like the world says. We say some really strange things. I've heard